To allow us as much time as we have to ourselves to talk about what we want to talk about. I just wanted to make sure everyone received Sienna's email with all the links and article, etc. I also wanted to ensure that everyone has seen the video. Yeah, okay, so I will not take up much time. I just wanted to tell you that the genesis of this afternoon is a series of intense conversations between Sienna and myself. Both had watched the video that Wednesday, and Sienna had already written a blog, and our perspectives were slightly different. Not hugely, but yes, there was I think a fundamental difference between the way I was reacting to the video and as Sienna was reacting to it. And I thought it would be a good opportunity, and by that time I think all of you had seen the video and 90 other million people had seen the video, so we thought that we will organize something, but not to talk about that video. I think a lot has been said and written about it, and it is a catalyst, I think, for all of us, and I hope there are many other groups such as this engaging with some of these issues. And what I think it made me realize is in this very connected, globally connected world where awareness is so heightened by social media, mass media, what is our role as professionals, development, human rights professionals, engaging with issues of social justice, home and abroad, in this context certainly abroad, what is the role and relevance of international advocacy groups and NGOs? Do they need to evolve? Should they exist as they are? And just as individuals in our organizations, our responsibility for ethical engagement. Once again, home and abroad. So this is what we wanted to discuss, and I'm not going to take more time than this, and perhaps I'll have another opportunity to speak to you about how I reacted to some of these issues. So without taking up more time, what I thought we'd start with is I'll open the floor for some of you to share your thoughts and reaction to after watching the video. Because we are not going to use the time to critique the video, but what were some of the big ideas and thoughts you thought about since you watched the video? And if you'd share around the table, then we can talk about the questions which we have set, or I'm sure you have other questions to discuss. So
I'm just warning you, we're on live, so I have to pass around the microphone.
And I'll also pass this microphone to this.
Oh, and Andy, you have to keep that microphone.
Okay.
This one can go around. Does anyone want to
raise you?
Circulate, maybe. Sorry, logistically difficult.
Sure, Miata, Roger, take it. Yeah, please.
Okay. I guess the video. My previous studies were in international development and globalization, and so I guess the video just kind of triggered a lot of things that I stopped thinking about since law school, and just about kind of, for me, it's mostly the discourse of and how we engage with, people in other countries, even poor people, or socially disadvantaged people, the article said, in Canada. And so it was, I'm sorry, I'm not very articulate right now, but sorry, I'm gonna pass it.
So, I was initially very shocked when watching the video by the sort of media components of it, almost as much as the message and the layers of that message, but the medium by which they were delivering the message, it was reminiscent of very intense propaganda, the way that it was able to boil down things to such simplistic levels to play on people's emotions. and how it coupled this with the viral video kind of phenomenon and its attempts at making a viral video. And so I was almost distracted while watching it by the engineering of its orchestration. And it raised a lot of concerns about how mass mentalities would be manipulated by it. When I first watched it, I looked online, and the Facebook group of Invisible Children was at 500,000 members. I looked online a couple of days later, and it was at 4 million members. And certainly many of those people are not going to be engaging with the complex subtleties of the debate at the level that we're about to today. And so I was concerned about the sort of mass effects that it would have. And I think that that's a relevant issue that we can discuss today is not just what these mean, but how voting trends and political activism can be, you know, organized in that kind of low-level but mass audience way.
Thanks. I think the thing that I thought was most interesting about the video was it raised for me the question of how a person should feel when they engage with an issue. So should you feel like you're a part of something? Should you feel like you're doing something good by clicking on the video? Or I think a lot of the video was about the people who were in it, and it was about people here being able to say they were doing something, but there wasn't actually much that was happening. So I think that's probably the biggest question I had coming out of the video.
Hi. Well, I guess a lot of the things have been said, but one thing that Miata mentioned resonated with me, but about the kind of discourse that surrounds development, especially international development, and the questions that are raised by having kind of mass mobilization of a population that is elsewhere and how that interacts with what the forces that are happening within the country and how to reconcile a genuine desire to help even, or help, but with kind of what the needs are locally and how people locally experience that kind of mobilization elsewhere.
I haven't seen the video yet. But I've been following the LRA and events in Uganda for the last 10 years, probably longer than most people. What's interesting about this this video is I think it's reached an audience which is not normally informed on these issues. And I think of an event I went to last night at Concordia about genocide, and there's a reporter from the Toronto Star there who covers international affairs, and he says that he first heard about the video from his 12-year-old son. And here he is a journalist covering international affairs, and he's finding out international issues from his 12-year-old son. So that's one of the amazing things about the video is how it's reached a crowd which normally doesn't cover yet or have an interest in these affairs.
Well, I guess after 30 seconds, I already got like a bit skeptic at the movie because of the first thing you see is a childbirth, hearing like really Americanized, and I thought that wasn't really a way to go into the problem, probably. And the message that every help is needed, but not mentioning that a lot of things is happening in Uganda at the moment. I think that's like always putting somebody they need everything you can give them, even like a whole shoe is something for them, not mentioning that like all the local engagement there is down there is a problem. And of course, like many others, afterwards I checked the website and I was pretty shocked that there weren't any further information about Kony or anything else. Like the only thing you can get is their action kit so you can put up posters. I found it weird that they didn't want to engage people more, give them more information in any way. I think that's what is one of the worst critiques, like my main problem.
When I first saw the video, I actually stopped it very early on into the video and didn't watch the rest of it. I sort of fast-forwarded to the part where the Jacob's being talked to, and he's being told that it's going to be a promise from now on that he's going to be saved. And right off the bat, I just didn't want to watch it, and I turned it off. And it wasn't until this kind of grew into a huge, full-blown conversation that everyone was having that I thought, well, before I'm actually going to give my real thoughts, I guess I should watch the entire thing. But my initial instinct was that it wasn't something that I wanted to see, because it was just, I sort of dismissed it, and it right off the bat, Uganda was referred to as somewhere in Central Africa, and I just, I didn't feel any appeal to particularly watch it, because I already wasn't exactly convinced by what they were saying. In terms of what our role is, I think it's important. I think it's really unfortunate that this had the opportunity to give people information in a way that makes them feel something, and it was done so very inaccurately, and I think that's really unfortunate. But I also think it's important that now we need to realize people do feel something towards Uganda, or towards this video, or towards people are having a conversation that they weren't previously having. And I think it's our role to harness that and now point them in the right direction of where they can get the accurate information. And I think that now when people read anything about the Kony 2012 video, their attention is piqued, and it's an opportunity for us, whether it's journalists or lawyers or students, and everyone in the community has a really, and I think it might be a fairly small window to sort of harness this energy and this emotion that's surrounding this video and use it to depict what's really going on. And I think that at least I already have had a lot of friends of mine emailing me about, are there organizations that we can look into, because they know that I've traveled to that area. And before that, no one was really interested that much in knowing about my experience there. But now everyone is sort of, I know you went there, so can you point me in the right direction, or what do I need to be looking at? And I think in that way, the video's sort of, it's giving us a unique opportunity.
I was really surprised at my reaction to the video. It was one of complete disengagement once I had seen the video and sort of started getting reactions from the people around me. And I was surprised at the number of people around me who also had the reaction of wanting to disengage and feeling like the best thing we could do was just sort of let go and take our hands off, just sort of back away and disassociate from the whole affair. And I became increasingly uncomfortable with that reaction because I felt like it wasn't very productive. It was sort of a not my fault kind of reaction. And that's why I'm here today, is because I'm interested in hearing how other people are engaging with the issue more productively.
Well, I won't repeat what much has already been said. One of the reactions was certainly astonishment as to the techniques of these sort of so professional filmmakers, that they're these techniques that they're using to touch our emotions and to voice their message. Astonishment also as to the content of the message, of course. Well, again, I just to add that I was very surprised that this was actually done recently. I thought when I started watching the video, and I also fast-forwarded when I first saw it because I couldn't stand it, and thought it was not really linked to Uganda or whatever, that this was actually not actual, or it would have been more relevant 10 years ago or whatever. And then I realized when I actually talked about the deployment of the U.S. soldiers and so on, this was done recently. Like, they're serious. This is their advocacy effort right now. So there was a lot of astonishment, a lot of surprise. And just to quickly add another point, it reminded me also a lot about the Darfur debate, and especially in 2004, 2005, I'd say, the huge debate about whether there's genocide going on or not, whether we should call this genocide or not. the whole argument that we sort of have to call this genocide so that people care about it, and this naming and branding and so on. So I saw quite some parallels. Thanks.
So I have two things. First of all, I'm running a program for Jewish high school students who are learning about the Holocaust. And I've run the program for a number of years. And the goal of the program is to connect what happened in World War II to mass atrocity crimes that are happening afterwards. And what we always ask the students to do is to sort of connect and see if they can identify, even locally, some sort of racism or some sort of discrimination that is systemic, not even globally, but even locally. And they're generally incapable of doing it. That's been our reaction over the past few years. This year, as we were leading the training, one of the counselors mentioned that we should be ready because obviously all these kids are going to mention Kony 2012, and they're going to connect what we're teaching them about creating awareness for genocides and mass atrocity crimes to this movie. And for me, that opened vistas in my mind. You know, for me, here's a tremendous opportunity to take a movie that touches on a lot of important points and open up a conversation with kids who've been really actively engaged. So that's the first thing. The second thing is in terms of the blowback and the reactions to the movie amongst people working in the field of human rights and Africa scholars. It's a very, very imperfect analogy, but it's a historical example we're thinking about that I researched recently. The Bergson Group during World War II was a Jewish group that also led very, very sort of shock advocacy efforts to get America to engage in what was happening in World War II and to basically save more Jews. And the reaction to that amongst the establishment Jewish communities was incredibly violent. They felt essentially that their voices had been usurped, that the proper methods and channels of communication had been overtaken by people who they considered were foreigners. Most of these people were from Mandate Palestine. They weren't American Jews. And the reaction was so forceful that they actually asked the President of the United States at the time to deport these people. And as a historical example, it's so clear now that the political infighting and the egos involved were so much more destructive to what was basically a common goal of all the people working in the field, but no one could see it at the time. The two examples are not directly comparable at all, but it is a very useful historical phenomenon that we can think about when we talk about the reaction to Kony 2012.
My reaction to the video was I felt trapped because I was recognizing the importance of the message and the importance of transmitting the message and making people aware. But at the same time, as I was watching the video, I was growing more and more uncomfortable with the way the message was portrayed, which is basically what it has been said here. I'm very interested. This is why I'm here. I'm not part of this community of human rights workers, but I like to learn and see other perspectives. There was a particular image in the video that stuck with me, and it's the image when the three of them arrive at the airport, and there is a shot from behind. And for me, that was particularly shocking because it kind of portrayed the saviors. The saviors are arriving. And that was what I felt was particularly disturbing about the video. Having said that, I had a very long conversation with my 19-year-old daughter who also gave me another perspective. She said, listen, a lot of people know about it. We're talking about it. It's an opportunity. It's something like what some of you have mentioned. So, I don't know.
So I'll just sort of speak briefly because a lot of the reactions have been covered already. And I guess partly because I didn't see the video or only saw parts of it after reading a lot of the criticism, so it's hard to separate the initial reactions or reactions from it from all the criticism, which I sort of believed in or bought into fairly easily. So I couldn't kind of imagine what my pure reaction would have been if I'd just seen it without knowing all the context. But I guess what I have been thinking about afterwards and seeing some of the criticism and the criticism of the criticism that people are saying, well, at least they're doing something, they're letting people know about it. And obviously, there's a lot you can fault it for presenting information very incompletely and kind of a biased perspective. But I was thinking kind of selfishly, like, what should I do about this? Or, I mean, just generally someone who's not really involved in development work and not someone who's likely to, you know, be directly involved in these initiatives, but I still want to be engaged and knowledgeable. Is there something that we should be kind of recommending that's not just, because not just knowing more about it, understanding the situation is very important, but kind of is there something that we can feel at least implicated in, but being still conscious of all the risks that go with it, about kind of seeing yourself as a savior and all those kind of problems in the portrayal, like a some kind of balance in there. So that's what I was trying to sort of see if there's an answer. And I mean, maybe there's no very easy answer here, but that's sort of something I was thinking about.
Can I speak in French? Because my... Okay. Ben, merci. Disons que le fait d'avoir un film sur un crime comme celui que Connie commet en Afrique et davantage sur les enfants intrigue toute personne de bonne conscience. Et moi, si je suis ici, c'est surtout parce que, comment dirais-je, ça me trouble beaucoup, mais... Je me dis, comment est-ce que ça a pris autant de temps pour que on le réalise et qu'on amène le maximum de personnes à prendre conscience d'un tel phénomène. C'est vrai qu'on peut dire qu'on a beaucoup de liberté avec Internet pour contacter le maximum de monde. Mais avant l'Internet, on avait quand même la télévision, on avait quand même le téléphone, on avait les journaux et tout. Comment est-ce qu'un individu comme ça peut avoir eu le temps de former des enfants soldats pendant des années sans qu'aucune organisation ne le sache? J'ai le sentiment qu'il y a une injustice quelque part. Et c'est une injustice qui n'est pas seulement de l'ordre isolé comme ce phénomène-là. C'est comme beaucoup d'injustices et beaucoup de crimes qu'on vit dans les pays africains et qui sont pourtant des crimes organisés parce qu'il y a des pays industrialisés qui viennent à la recherche des ressources. Et je pense que cette guerre, cette formation d'enfants soldats n'est pas isolée de toutes les conflits qu'il y a dans la sous-région entre les différentes idéologies et les différents exploitants. Mais c'est peut-être déjà un grand espoir qu'on soit tous sensibilisés à l'existence d'un tel crime.
So I guess as an education student, I saw the video and the comments, the conversations about the video in a little bit of a different light, I guess, in terms of like non-formal and or incidental education, just looking at how many different ways people are learning and the different bearings and effects that this can have on them emotionally. I mean, I saw people, I guess, on my Facebook get more defensive about this and attacks on this video than I've seen. You know, it brought up a lot of emotions, and just for me, it made me think about the way that we teach and the way that we learn and how important it is to have those conversations around what we're learning and what we're teaching, and also obviously the contextualization of it as well.
For me, it really made me question the utility of raising awareness as opposed to educating, like raising awareness to catch Kony. I think people who need to know about Kony already knew, so there wasn't a need to really raise awareness. It was more a need to educate about issues like this, not necessarily just Kony, but also issues in Africa and other countries in general. So yeah, it just made me question just why are we needing to tell people this now when And there was also an urgency in the video that I didn't understand. The US had already sent advisors. So why is there an urgency to keep them there when there is no one saying that they're going to pull them out? So, just really questioning the utility of telling people things like this. But then I also agree it's important to open up discussions like this. But I don't think that was done in the correct manner.
I guess I'll just add a little brief commentary. I guess one thing that I really, when we were talking about harnessing the power of this video or the reaction to it, I guess I'll just add that I think I was actually kind of disappointed with how people who, like my friends or my friends' friends who don't normally engage in these issues, how quickly they dropped the conversation. I know, like, I tried to initiate, you know, send some articles around after people expressed their support for the video, so to engage in, like, a meaningful dialogue. But I guess I was just really surprised at how quickly it died out. And even though it seemed to be millions of people who were on board with engaging with the issue.
So I have a particular perspective, but I also wanted to tell everybody, I'm here from the McGill Reporter. I'm going to be writing about the discussion. And John Kelsey is taking pictures, so I hope that's okay with everybody. So my perspective is that I was actually in Uganda in the late 80s, and people did know about Kony. People knew about the children soldiers. And I was working with the NGOs, and people were wondering what to do. You know, it was known, but it wasn't known in the way that this is known. Like a lot of you, I didn't like the video. I had a lot of very negative reactions to the tone of voice, to a whole bunch of different things in there. But what I thought is interesting is that we're part of a world where governments endlessly promise that they're going to act, and they don't act. So that you know, governments promise X amount of dollars for aid for specific projects, and it seems to me it's sort of a model, and it's a very self-conscious model. It's like a teaching model of how to use the internet to push people. And so that was what the main thing I got from it was, that was an interesting thing. Just that it was kind of okay, whether or not Kony is still a real problem. Here's a model, and this is, I guess, what a lot of you are saying.
Once I saw the video, I was trying to figure out which was the real purpose of the message. Which one was the focus of the problem? Was it only one focus, or was it multifocal? Then I also tried to figure out to whom was it directed, to whom was directed the message to. So I felt that there was like only one part of the story said. There was something missing because there was a lack of contextualization. And for me, the half-true is misinforming, which has devastating effects. So they suggest that they were going to redeem the world, they were going to change it, but how can isolated and sporadic actions really redeem the world? A really complex problem which was kind of simplified, and that idea of a good man for me, well, it implies the idea of the bad man. It implies the idea of a good man. So who is the good man? Is it the white man? Is it the first world that has to go and help and the saviors of the third world? So that's what I thought about it.
Many of my reactions, all of them have really already been catalogued, so I'll pass it on.
I also don't want to repeat because I agree with much of what has been said. One observation that I have to make about the video is that the use of children in it made me really, really uncomfortable. And it brought up the question of consent, like, did the people actually consent to having their images used in that way? And not only the way Jacob's image was used made me uncomfortable, but also the way the filmmaker's young son was used kind of just threw me off a bit, because it seemed to really instrumentalize the children in a way.
Thank you.
Any other thoughts on the video? No? Oh, okay. Because we have...
Just one quick comment. I think the video is the discussion and the comments are around the contents of the video and not about the events which caused the video to be made. So that's just an observation about the scene.
Sure. Apologize for my brain lapse before. I wasn't ready to start thinking. But one thing, what I really did think about was just, like, a lot of the conversation has been about, and I brought it up, like, the discourse of the video itself, but also the way that, like, the discourse will shape the action. And so I think Alex talked about it, whether awareness in itself is a goal. And I'm really not sure that it is, because that's what now the filmmakers are saying, you know, it's okay that we use 50% of our budget for salaries and videos because our goal is to raise awareness. Then if awareness is your goal and if it's being done in this way that's so problematic, it's like there are effects, you know? So you can say that when this there was a reporter, I read about the reporter whose child was the one who alerted him to the video. And so then we're seeing that people who are reporters, politicians, policymakers might have the same level of awareness as these teenagers from this video, and it has real effects. And so, you know, what's going to happen? Like, I think that the creators of Invisible Children would probably like to see more increased militarization in the region. Is that really a good idea? I don't think so for this kind of conflict. In the legal context, the ICC has only indicted Kony, and the Ugandan government has well-documented human rights abuses against people in the northern region. So it's like, it's not just, I guess it's not enough to say that, like, look, all these people know about this now, because I think that they know about it in a way that's not accurate and problematic, and it has real potential implications.
You, yeah. The only thing I'd say is, and I had written it up for my introductory remarks, is to understand a context, it could take years, if not decades, of dedicated study to understand, and particularly if you are not from there. And I don't think that each one of us will have that opportunity to do that. So yes, they are Africa scholars, and they are Uganda scholars, and they're probably scholars who are studying post-conflict justice and transitional justice, transformation, post-conflict. There are so many. I would take that point about awareness and education. So if we think that raising awareness is not enough, then what is the role of an advocacy organization? I looked up before this session, what is it? Because we use all the time, it's an advocacy group. What do they educate or they raise awareness? I looked up what they do. Traditionally, what they have done, history of advocacy. And perhaps people may want to react to it. Advocacy groups are not to educate people. They have a role and they play it quite effectively, locally and internationally. They have done so. So I'd like to just make that distinction. They are not, I know human rights organization dedicated to educating people, dedicating to training human rights professionals. Advocacy groups are different, and then there are activists who do things very differently. So therefore, there are a range of non-state actors, civil society actors, who are engaged with similar issues. So this is just one, and we didn't like, if I understand correctly, the form and content of the video, and I think there is a consensus. So we will probably not focus too much on that video as such. And Madame, vous avez dit avant la internet, on a eu des télévisions. Well, I did not have television until I was 22 years old. In our state, we didn't have television. So I actually didn't have television. And I wanted to engage with the rest of the world, and I did not have very sophisticated understanding of many parts of the world. So how do we do that, and what such videos have done to people who had never heard of LRA? So we are at a university at the Faculty of Law, and our audience is very smart and sophisticated law students who've had extensive background in development, social justice issues, Faculty of Education, other universities. But literally, if you took a poll in Montreal, particularly in the suburbs, LRA. How many people would have heard of it? So I'm just trying to ask you a question, role of advocacy organization, and if there is a role, and they do play a relevant role, then how should they do it? What is their responsibility? They do exist, and they'll continue to exist, at least in the near future.
Can I just add one quick thing to that? Before answering the question, I think it might be worth sort of picturing this type of video, perhaps in an improved form and improved communication of content in the, for example, the Syrian context. Would we be having a different conversation? What would we think of such a means of communication when events are much more, well, comparatively to the LRA, much more immediate and urgent?
And just do not forget Rwanda. 94, we did not have any of it, and many people really did not know the scale of atrocities happening in Rwanda. So, and a radio in Rwanda, the state-controlled radio, could incite so much violence in that context, and there was no counter to it. So Professor Akhawan, who should be here, has argued that if international, forces, governments had used blocking devices to block the video, I think some damage could have been controlled. So, but we did not have a counter to it. There were no cell phones, or if there were, they were not this sophisticated, and certainly there was no social media. So I just want us to think about it. And of course, you all have the questions, so you can pick on any other question. And it'll be very helpful to think together on these issues. Menachem?
In looking at the critiques, what I tried to do was basically read one pro Invisible Children article for every anti one, which was actually difficult, but it was interesting to see where the camps line up, and this has to do with my point before about egos and about the sort of sociology of development work, which I guess it's a tricky subject. It was interesting to see that Nicholas Kristof was a big promoter of the video, so I'm sure probably most people know who Nicholas Kristof is, but a friend of mine went to a talk of his at Fordham a few years ago, and she sort of shed more light on his background. Nicholas Kristof is a very, very popular columnist for the New York Times, and he writes about development work. And before I'd had this talk with my friend, I really did not give him the time of day. I felt like the way he wrote was incredibly populist, was incredibly simplistic. I didn't think much of it. She explained that, Nick Kristof is actually a Rhodes Scholar. He actually has the ability of speaking incredibly intelligently and in a very nuanced way about the issues. And, you know, as a very, very dedicated person, he had a goal of sort of fomenting change in the world in a positive direction. And he tried to do this in an academic and a nuanced way for a number of years, and it didn't work. And he stopped. And he realized that when he wrote, focusing in on specific stories of people, taking complex issues, trying to distill some sort of simple moral distinction, he could actually get people to engage. And he made the really conscious distinction of doing that. I think it's very similar to what Invisible Children is doing. I don't have nearly enough expertise on Uganda, but when you look at their reaction on the site to the critiques, and when you look at their letter to Obama, you know, a lot of the stereotypes that are kind of being created about the organization sort of fall apart, because on the one hand, they're running this incredibly populist campaign, so they can say, I have 100 million people who really support me. On the other hand, when they meet the policymakers, you know, they're saying a lot more than that, than what's in the video. So we have to keep that sort of discrepancy in mind. And again, we have to ask ourselves, would a nuanced video, a accomplish, would it get the sort of attention?
Oh, I have a microphone. Sorry. I think that's a good point. I just wanted to just draw your attention to one video I sent around by a school in northern Uganda for children who have been child soldiers, and it's called Hope North. And I just thought it was a really good point of comparison for the type of awareness that was being raised by the IC video versus the type of awareness that Hope North video was trying to raise. And I think in their simplicity, they had very similar goals to draw attention to the LRA, to draw attention to abuses suffered by child soldiers, but they were done in such fundamentally different ways, shockingly different ways, and had the exact same outcomes. So I think with invisible children, especially, like, the point is not to sort of rant about invisible children, but I think with their capacity and their experience in Uganda, it was really sad that that's the kind of, or disappointing that's the kind of work they could produce, whereas there's alternatives. But if you have a chance, I sent you the link in your information.
So I think this, what you were saying is really interesting, and this idea of how simple do we have to make a message in order for it to be accessible. And in many ways, that kind of reminds me of movies or books like Eat, Pray, Love, where people have kind of a first-level understanding of maybe a country like India, and then that affects that's pretty much the extent of how far they'll go to thinking about things. And on some level, I think maybe that's okay, but I think, Sienna, what you're saying about there are many different ways of conveying a message, and I think that I think it's important that if a movie that would be better, that would allow us to better understand the issues, I don't think would start off with I think the access point to empathy in that movie was through images of white faces in the U.S., which I don't think is how we should initially access empathy for children in Uganda. And I think that when you're in high school, and people have talked about how education and how a lot of young people have responded to this movie, I think when you are in high school, you do have a more simplistic approach to problems, but I do think it's important that we educate children to have empathy that's related to individual human beings who may be different from them, but they don't have to access that empathy through their own experiences. That's all I would say.
I just had one thing that came to mind when you were talking about Eat, Pray, Love as well. In my law and poverty class, we had a discussion recently, a book club, where we read this book called Nickeled and Dimed, and it's about this woman who is a white middle-class journalist who spends time 1 month at a time living the life of someone on minimum wage. And I found that actually we spoke about it in our class in small groups, and a lot of the criticism that people had of the book, at least in the people I was discussing it with, were so centered. One of my reactions to our own discussion was that it was so centered on the construction of the information being presented. For example, why does the information have to come from a white person or a middle-class person instead of from someone who tells their own real life story and all of those kinds of things? And I agree that it's very problematic in many ways. But I found, though, that by centering the conversation so much on that, we were actually, and you made this comment, not discussing the content, not discussing what she was trying to actually say. And so I think that one thing that I've noticed in the kind of aftermath of Kony is that so much of this discussion has been critical, the critical discussion has come from people, like Alex was mentioning, who are already aware, and it's people who already know the issues. And I think that perhaps then kind of it's unfortunate that a lot of the discourse that's happening that's trying to bring the real issues or a better kind of perspective, whatever that entails, to the table is happening among people who ostensibly already are engaging with that perspective. And I think that the issue for us as, you know, human rights activists, journalists, things like that, is to not so much, well, criticize, sure, and provide information, but also to take note of why that was so impactful and come up with a way of sharing our information in a way that is equally impactful rather than shifting the conversation entirely to a criticism of it. And and the second thing I had to say was back to Nandini's question about advocacy and awareness. And I think that it's
I don't really know where I stand on this, but I think it's kind of interesting because when you're advocating for, when there's an organization that's advocating, ideally the population is aware of what position that they are coming from. And a lot of the problem with awareness organizations is that there are these underlying motivations, but it's kind of, it's less easy to see what is driving people because they're not kind of driving home a specific point on the face of it. And I think that's where a lot, at least for me, of kind of my wariness comes, is when what's being presented as objective and neutral information is actually coming from a very specific corner, and it's being presented as something that is, you know, objective in the mind of the receiver of the information.
I know Roger has a point, but I'd just like to put this in perspective, and I have thought about it. So a billion some people in China and a billion people in India, billion plus. China has about, I think, internet access. I just looked up the data for something else, not for this. It's very high, 40-some percent people. India, it's fairly low. And then there are people, you know, we'd say 180 million Russians, and there's Middle East, and I'm sure I'm forgetting people. I don't think many people have watched Kony video there. This is just... think about who it is targeted for. Who are these 90 million people who have watched this video? So there are 320 million people. And then we are 33 million, and there's Europe. I don't know, Western Europe. I would actually, it's a great, for me, somebody, I challenge you to look at the users. Who has actually watched this video? And that, I think, would be your answer, who this video was made for and why it is so Americanized and what is the purpose of this video. So yes, they do need to raise funds, and the only way to relate to the, you cannot relate to the other, the empathy, you have to have this whole American perspective for Americans to feel empathy, a child like yours. Look, it has to be. That is a marketing strategy. So it's, I think they're quite aware of it, what they're doing. And we can discuss this to death that it's unethical, but they are operating in a context, they are working in a society, and that's the society which they have targeted. And that's what I'd like to remind ourselves, that it'll be very interesting to see. I'm sure people in China and India are also equally unaware of LRA and its atrocities and its continuing atrocities in Central African Republic and DRC and in South Sudan, but they haven't watched the video. So we just need to remind ourselves that also. Advocacy organizations often tend to be quite local. They're doing international work, but their constituency is very, very local, and that's who they are trying to appeal to. Sorry, Roger.
No. Thanks for bringing it back to the Western aid advocacy context. I think that's really important. Everybody lauds the, praises the video for its ability at manipulation and the skill with which it was made. And there's a lot of critique about the message. I particularly like Miata's comments about how it might be steering the message in uncomfortable ways. But What has come up in our discussions and in many other discussions is the sort of net benefit defense that the messages in their simplicity still have a net benefit. I think that's some of what Menachem was touching at, that they were achieving their Western aid advocacy objectives even though they were simplifying things and there was a net benefit. But what hasn't been discussed, I think, enough is the sort of negative outcomes that come from moral licensing, which is the phenomenon of where people do things which they feel are morally good, that they're contributing, and that consequently they will contribute negatively in other ways that they otherwise would. And this has been objectively studied in quantifiable ways in a lot of different fields. And I think we have to ask ourselves if there needs to be more pressure on controlling such mass media kind of targets, which will have not just distracting from other important goals, but negative effects on how much Western aid as a focus group needs to be accomplishing or is accomplishing. And so literally quite negative effects of this approach, of this message, of mass media approach that that I think the debate also needs to take into account a bit.
I just want to talk briefly about, I guess, NGOs and maybe touching a little on the article, one of the articles Sienna posted. I didn't read it all, but it's talking about like the managerial logic of NGOs. And so I think that there was a question as to like why like such a sense of urgency in the video, and also, you know, the fact that Kony is no longer in Uganda anymore at all. But it's just the way kind of like NGOs, they're like they're corporations, and so they kind of have to justify themselves and they have to keep going. And so, you know, when they started Invisible Children, they did start it like at a particularly bad time in the region, and it takes a long time. And so they kind of, I guess it's kind of like, we're not going to stop now, so we finally made this video, we got all this money, and we're going to do it because that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to advocate for this. And so I guess it's like a bigger question of like NGOs being more self-aware and being willing sometimes to maybe say, okay, maybe the life of our campaign is over, or maybe we'll put our resources with other NGOs who are doing this already or similar work, you know, and instead of just for keep doing something just because. So.
Thank you. So I had two main things that I've been thinking a lot about since seeing the video, and one of them, in terms of the other video that you sent, Sienna, I really tried to think about, I loved that video, but when I was watching it, and I'd be interested in maybe if other people watched it to know what they thought, it meant a lot to me because all of the little cinematography things that they were doing, I recognized, whether it's the road or what they're, like they're eating shima, or all of the little intricacies of the video spoke to me because of my experiences. But I thought, for someone who's never been there or hasn't been to the region at all, I don't know really if they would feel anything towards this video. And I think that's exactly what you were touching upon in terms of this Kony video was made for Americans. And the problem is that when it, that's fine, but when you say that you're advocating on behalf of Ugandans, I think that's where the problem arises. And I think it's very, because as well from a journalism perspective, I keep trying to think, why is it that there are so many accurate documentaries with a fuller picture of the context that don't get this kind of attention? And in terms of when you were sort of touched upon, we have to think, is a video that had more context, would it have gotten that kind of attention? Because there, not everyone would jump on it to criticize it. So I think it's just interesting to just think of how there's clearly a lot of Americans who want to do something, and I think that's why it was so powerful, is that people watch a lot of documentaries that don't involve them and the issue. It involves the issue, and then maybe like a little, if you want to do something, you can look at this. But I also see the danger in that, and I've sort of wondered, what repercussions will this have on Uganda? Is it going to be flooded with just tons and tons of NGOs created maybe by younger people? That I think that's amazing if they want to go and help, but there also needs to be a lot more dialogue, and there's already a lot of very irresponsible non-governmental organization work that's happening in that region that I think I worry about, at least, and I worry about what this is going to do to Uganda if they're not a lot more involved in this dialogue. So yeah, those were just a couple of thoughts I had.
Thanks, Jacqueline. You answered, actually, or touched on the question five.
A question about NGO and media and how should they engage. But I'll just take a moment to say hello to Professor Paya Makavan, who's just arrived. And I think many of you already know, but you have done work in Uganda, right? I will give you the microphone.
Maybe after the next question? Or
okay.
Should I do that?
Why don't you just introduce yourself? Because we have people from not from the faculty.
Oh, I see.
So you should introduce yourself
and then... Should I make an intervention or just introduce myself?
Introduce and then talk.
before Harry.
No, after. Just introduce them, what you've done in Uganda, and then Celeb goes.
I'm sorry, complex instructions. I'm sorry, I'm late. Sounds like a very interesting discussion. I am Pai Makoban. I teach here at the law faculty, and I spent about a decade working with the UN in various war zones, and at one point in time I acted as counsel to the government of Uganda, actually proposed the referral of the Lord's Resistance Army case to the International Criminal Court, which was actually part of a policy of trying to deny the Lord's Resistance Army its rear bases in southern Sudan, from which it could operate in northern Uganda, and then retreat behind the international boundaries, which the Ugandan forces could not cross without creating effectively an international armed conflict. And so in a remarkably short span of time from the referral of that case in December of 2003, within 1 or 2 years, basically the armed conflict had ended in northern Uganda. One aspect of it was that the Europeans that were pressuring Uganda to negotiate a peace settlement with the Lord's Resistance Army were forced to see Joseph Kony as a criminal as opposed to a partner in a future Ugandan government, which is extraordinarily cynical to begin with, that the idea that one could include someone like Joseph Kony in a government. And the second point is that there was a very successful policy of amnesties, which allowed a significant number of the child soldiers given the opportunity to defect, but also peace negotiation partners were defecting all the time, to the point where there was no one to negotiate with because everyone was defecting given the opportunity. So this very simple policy leveraged the ICC to pressure the Europeans, to pressure Sudan at a time when the armed conflict with the South had ended and the Sudanese didn't have the same use for the LRA, which they used to destabilize Uganda. And maybe I will not speak much further about the Kony 2012 video now, but the first thing that came to my mind when seeing this is, well, they're a decade too late. And while it's great for the world to know who Joseph Kony is, the Acholi-Land region is now thriving, and it is doing extraordinarily well. And the threat remains clearly in the Congo, and Kony is still able to inflict significant damage and to terrorize remote communities, but he is a small shadow of his former self. If you remember that in 2003, thousands of children were abducted. So those images of these night commuters really are from a decade ago. And I wonder whether the real problem in capturing him is that the 100 American forces in the Ugandan army don't have enough resources and they need us to fundraise for them, as opposed to the many, many worthy initiatives in Acholi lands, the many NGOs that are trying to help rehabilitate these former child soldiers, of which there are tens of thousands. So I'm just going to maybe end there and listen to what you have to say.
Points. Perhaps we should also talk about what these U.S. soldiers don't have enough resources for. I'm not sure what they're actually trying to accomplish in Uganda. But just to follow up on just briefly on the discussion before on that we had on the two videos and comparing Hope North with Kony 2012, I just wanted to confirm that even though I have not been to northern Uganda or Uganda at all, that I was still very touched by that and that I could relate to it. Of course, it is not so much targeted, I think, to a purely U.S. or I think mostly U.S.-based audience, and not only to what I think the Kony 2012 video is targeted to, also a very young audience. And if you compare just a different speed of it, it just makes it obvious that with the very, very extremely fast speed of the Kony video, that reaches, obviously, even though it is so long, can reach out to many people with the other very slow and I think more accurate altogether. It's just the speed captures much more. It reflects much more, much better the situation. And you can't reach, apparently, the same audience. But I also wanted to say something about what Nandini said before, about raising awareness and reaching, you know, these tens of millions of people. And if you, for instance, conducted a poll somewhere in any city before the video, no one would have heard of the LRA, of course. Now, just a point here, I think we're sometimes confusing means and ends here, and I think with the Kony video, you know, the means sort of become the ends. It's sort of the numbers, and you see it with the Facebook friend numbers, that's sort of the end, and it's about raising awareness, it's about numbers, it's about reaching as many people as possible. Now, I'm not arguing for completely elite-driven or technocratic decision-making when it comes to foreign policy, humanitarian aid, whatever. I think educated citizens, it's always important, it's always better to have, you know, a stronger basis. That's the basis of our democracy, if the decisions are made in accordance with what the constituency actually, what the people believe. But do we need those, in the US, tens of millions of people knowing about the LRA to make an informed decision? I'm not arguing against awareness raising altogether. I think it's good, but I think sometimes we tend to believe that this is absolutely necessary to be able to do something. Well, why couldn't we do something about it, even if a huge portion of the population does not know about it? We have development projects in all over the world, and people don't know what's going on in very poor places, and the aid's still going there, the projects are still funded. It's not necessary to educate or to raise awareness, whatever it is, about everything to be able to do something.
I'd just like to respond. One thing I want to tell you, I think it's awareness, yes, but it's a fundraising campaign. And that's why I think we need to question the role and relevance of international NGOs as such. And I think there have been all kinds of reports that they spend 33% on administration, etc. No, they don't, actually. They don't spend that much more than any other INGO spends. And I also would like to share another statistics with you, that why would Americans want to give to invisible children when they don't know where Uganda is and what it is for? Because another statistics, which is probably for me startling, was that less than 10% of Americans have passports. So people don't travel. So if they don't travel, and media, U.S. media is mostly focused on U.S. I mean, if you're watching what right now any media outlet, it is about presidential primaries. So if you want to raise money for something which is in a country called Uganda, then this is what you do, and it has been proven very effective. And I wouldn't be surprised if many other campaigns such as this will be launched in the near future. So that what is the purpose. So the debate of whether we need to educate and make people, the whole nation, aware of what it is, I think the purpose is twofold. Yes, awareness, but in the guise of awareness, it's raising money. And I think they have met their target, I think. So that's what it is.
Just the next question is, what are they using the money for? What kind of awareness, or what's their objective then?
Mm-hmm.
And I think their objective is, you know, it's quite clear, right? They want to pressure the U.S. government. They want to bring in, give more means to the Ugandan military and so on in order to capture Kony. So since this is not really, as you said, they're 10 years too late with that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, their objectives have been met. They have raised all this money. That's what you're saying, right? An effective fundraising campaign.
That's what the purpose of the video is. And at this point, I could be very cynical about many of the international, you know, trials and manhunt for evil people, but I won't be, because I don't think this forum, we wanted to organize to have really a discussion on how to move forward. And I think the last question is something we all should engage with, which is how international and local civil society actors forge a real partnership to achieve a common objective in the future. So I think it's a good lesson to learn, that I think it's not that Ugandans or people in that region, Central African Republic or South Sudan, those who have been subject to atrocities of Kony or likes of Kony, don't want Kony to be captured or his goons. So it, there is a common objective here. And they have amassed vast resources, a small invisible children from San Diego, they have. But how, your question is what they're going to spend this on. And that is a question, how do you forge? Because, and the, I think all of you have mentioned that there's a vibrant civil society in Uganda, particularly in northern Uganda, doing extraordinary work. And there is a lot documented on that. So how, instead of having these two parallel universes, and that's why I the very first question I asked was relevance of these large NGOs and advocacy groups standalone. And how should they do it? So I can't answer your question what they should spend it on, but I think this whole world needs to rethink itself. And Miata's point about, or did you, or did, that there'll be NGOs need to justify their existence, and that's, I think, a very old. It's an industry, and they need to justify, they reinvent themselves. So I think it's a moment in time to think about that. Yeah.
I actually want to disagree. I think the purpose of the video goes a little bit beyond fundraising. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because we're talking about this as an international development issue. It could also be seen as an American political lobbying issue, which is a totally different conversation. Mm-hmm. It's a lot narrower, and the lobbying industry in the United States has its own dynamics that need to be understood. At the end of the day, this is a movie that I think is clearly geared towards Americans. It's geared towards Americans in an election year. And I can remember from when I was working with Stan that election years are seen by these organizations as a time where they can get politicians to make promises that they can later follow up on. And by getting 60, 70 million Americans to watch this video and show some sort of support, I'm assuming that Invisible Children feels like it can create some sort of change that way. So it's not just about the money that they're raising. They're actually trying to, as a lobbying organization, what they're trying to do is move the gigantic behemoth that is United States foreign policy in a way that is going to benefit northern Ugandans, victims of the LRA. And again, when you look at their policy asks that they make in that letter, there are a lot, they deserve to be debated by people who know a lot more about Uganda than I do, but they seemed a lot more nuanced than I think what people are reacting to around the table. And my point here is to really disagree. I mean, you do need that popular support. The choice here is not between people who are interested in a nuanced way about development work or people who are interested in a simplistic way about development work. It's generally between people who are interested in a simplistic way about development work or people who are completely apathetic and skeptical and against the idea. And especially in the political climate right now in the United States, with Tea Partiers, with neo-isolationists, development budgets are getting cut drastically. And if this is sort of a move to sort of reverse that trend and to get people engaged in even a minimal way in order to influence American foreign policy, then that seems to me a worthy goal. If people are completely apathetic and non-engaged, then the other lobbies that also exist in the United States, which are mining lobbies, which are business lobbies, they're the ones that win, and America's foreign policy interests get to reflect that instead of this. So it becomes a bit of a zero-sum game, and that's where the stakes actually can lie very high, and where critiques of the video, when they get so public that they create mass skepticism, might actually endanger the sort of common interest that all of these development workers have.
I just wanted to maybe just add a few things. The situation is that Kony is a ruthless and cunning man. There's a reason why he survived for so long against the odds. American soldiers can provide intelligence, satellite imagery, tracking devices. The African soldiers know the bush far better than any of the Americans. I can tell you that. That's, you know, the Ugandans, the Congolese, the Central African, Southern Sudanese armies, they're the ones that know the bush. So the idea that if we have like an expeditionary force of 50,000 American paratroopers, we're going to get this guy, that's not the way it works. And it took the best army in the world how many years to catch Osama bin Laden in far more favorable circumstances. So it's not easy. It's not easy to capture one man. So my question is more one of, what does this video really represent? Is it a lobbying effort to enlighten U.S. foreign policy? Well, why did the U.S. give those 100 soldiers to Uganda? Well, because Uganda is one of the U.S. allies in the war on terror in the Horn of Africa. Uganda is sending soldiers in Somalia, so is Kenya, so is Ethiopia. It's a tit for tat. That's why, without any public pressure, the Americans said, here are 100 soldiers, here's the satellite imagery. Getting back to what you're saying, it's not because it's an election issue. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to make these things election issues. In Rwanda, perhaps, instead of people worrying about the Monica Lewinsky scandal, the O.J. Simpson trial, they could have worried about a million people being butchered in Rwanda. That would have been a good thing. Not that Hollywood makes a film 10 years later where we feel guilty, and at the same time as we feel guilty, Darfur is unfolding, and it's the same charade all over again. This is the problem, that it's an illusion of progress without any meaningful empathy, any meaningful engagement. It's a kind of self-indulgent sentimentality, and that's what concerns me. And I just want to say, when I was in Bosnia working with the UN, I spoke to some women who were victims of sexual violence because we wanted them to testify in the trials, and it was very difficult to get people to come forward. I was shocked at the reaction of some of these women when we went to speak with them, when they were intensely hostile to us. And their remark was, are you out to make money from my suffering? Because I'm sick and tired of speaking to the 100th NGO that goes in the streets of Sarajevo saying, are you a Muslim? Are you a rape victim? Can I interview you? There were probably about 20 NGO reports, all on the same subject, the subject of, is rape being used as a weapon of war in Bosnia? Yes, it is being used. And many women were re-traumatized time and again, left with no resources to actually help heal their trauma, so that NGOs could publish reports on the issue that was the flavor of the month and raise funds. So that, to me, is an exploitation. It has nothing to do with actually doing anything meaningful to change people's lives. And that's the problem. We're stuck between a society that's clearly apathetic, doesn't give a damn, is more concerned about Hollywood gossip, the ice hockey scores, whatever the issue may be. But on the other hand, do we fall in a situation where we raise awareness without really changing anything on the ground and just perpetuating an industry? And I just want to end with one provocative thought from an excellent book written by Elizabeth Spellman, professor of English, who has written a book called The Fruits of Sorrow. And in the last part of the book, she justifies the title. She says, suffering is an arable field in which some do the hard work and others arrive just in time for the harvest. You sow the seeds and I pluck the fruits of sorrow. So we have to ask ourselves, is this really empathy or is it exploitation? And does it necessarily result in progress? Is it sometimes better actually to steer clear of a situation rather than to actually create a situation which will disempower and marginalize those that are at the front lines? Sorry, I'm going to stop there. Because
just take the mic. Yeah, I'll give her the microphone. Just a second. No, we still have...
I just want to comment that some of your comments with regards to Bosnia are very similar to, I think, reports we're hearing from northern Uganda. So there was a couple of screenings of the video. I think one of them ended in a small riot, which could have been started for a number of reasons that I'm not aware of. I wasn't there. But from friends and colleagues who work as journalists in the region and who are from the region and family in the region, I think there's a sense of why are we making Kony famous? Like, not quite understanding what the point of the video is in the first place, why it's relevant to their context, and sort of feeling bulldozed by this American objective, or policy objective, as you seem to be calling it. So I think it's worth keeping those thoughts in mind. Thank you for that contribution.
Can I speak?
Yes, so, we need to just give you the microphone.
So one of the things that I wanted to say is that I remember hearing Romeo Dallaire being interviewed on CBC years ago, and he said, if only I'd used the right word to the UN, my UN bosses, and it was, I forget, it wasn't collateral damage at that point, but it was something to say, people are being killed. If I'd used the right word that the bureaucrats understood, that things would have stopped earlier on, because they would have reacted earlier on. So it seems to me that the Kony video is... there are lots of things wrong with it. It's not, Kony isn't the big issue in even in Africa right now. You know, we can talk about Somalia, we can talk about Darfur, where there's not nearly so much attention. But it's like the video is about learning the language, I think, to move stuff. You know, if we say that there is an international engagement that is not just at the level of NGOs, it's saying to people, you too have a... And maybe it's moving, maybe it is the election year, maybe it's... I just think there is an interesting thing going on in terms of the video, you know? And it's a bit what happens next, I think. And what happens with all that money?
No, absolutely, I think. And therefore, how best to spend that money and the goodwill and the awareness, how best to move forward... And that is the question. I think people in the Ugandan civil society are not happy about the approach they have taken. And I have been part of the NGO community as working for an NGO for a very long time, funding NGOs on the other side of the spectrum. And I have seen both sides, funding local NGOs, funding foreign NGOs, then moving to the partnership model, South-South partnership models, and there are many lessons learned. But I think I came to the conclusion a while ago that we need to rethink. I think there is an industry. This is like the military-industrial complex. There is the civil NGO advocacy group industrial complex. And we need to rethink how to engage. I think I for once, don't agree that we should not engage. I think in this the world we are living in, I think we should engage. But how is the question? And I think that is what we were hoping to get from many of you. If you have thoughts about it, how we could move forward, and what lessons learned from not just Invisible Children or this video. This is really a speck in the debate in the NGO world. What are the ethical issues?
Just to maybe start that off, I think one thing that I keep having in the back of my mind is one sort of good thing that came out of this video, sort of incidentally, is the fact that a lot of civil society members from Uganda are sort of coming to the forefront. So I think being featured in mainstream media that they probably would generally not have access to. Some of the journalists would anyways, but I think a lot of people that, just a couple friends, about 24, 25, who've been working civil society, who have been working for their communities, since they can remember, are now coming to the forefront. I think that's fantastic. I think as students, perhaps we have the ability to, and this is a very small, minute suggestion, but to sort of feature these voices more strongly, to start bringing them to the faculty, for example, to start bringing them to these communities and giving them a platform from which to speak, right? Because that's one of the main critiques of this video, is that it takes away any sense of agency, it takes away any role of civil society actors, community activists in Uganda, in northern Uganda, in the process of ending the atrocities caused by the LRA. So I think that's one small suggestion. I'm happy to speak with anyone after and how that would actually look in practice.
I have just a quick comment about going forward. I guess just when we were discussing, it seemed to me like we were talking a lot about giving information to the public and how they're receiving all of these messages. And I guess like, it kind of goes back to what I was talking about before about my reaction to the video, is that people really don't have the tools or the skills to analyze any of the information that we're giving them, which is, I guess, why we give them simplistic messages. But as like a going forward kind of suggestion, I guess, that might be an area that we would want to look at more, like giving people in our communities or in our friendship groups or whatever more or suggestions on how they can engage with that kind of material instead of just being pawns for policy machines or that kind of thing, to just like stamp their name on any sort of moving target or video that anyone produces and really help them to engage more critically with information. And also just to go to that point as well, there was a lot of, with all the negative critiques that we had, I think that maybe encouraged people to disengage with ever supporting like development work maybe or other kinds of initiatives. So I think we as people who do maybe do have the skills to critique those kinds of messages should be careful about how we portray those to people who are just starting to engage with these issues. So I don't know, those are things that I thought about.
Ryan, we still have 5-7 minutes.
Okay. Anyone? I'm just going to say, I think in order to change this industry, we need to really try and instill accountability within advocacy groups. Who are they accountable to? They're not accountable to the people they're telling the information to. They're more accountable to the people they claim to be speaking on behalf of. And they're really at the... They're commanding sort of the headwaters of the information going through. So they really need to be more... more responsible in their message that they're putting through.
Maybe just by way of summary, when I think about sort of the laws of economics, supply and demand, I would say in the other half of the world where people suffer physical hardship, there is a demand. There is a demand for resources, there's a demand for know-how, and clearly that's a call that we should try to respond to. In the other half of the world where there is not physical hardship, but a kind of postmodern consumerist emptiness, where we're in search of meaning, finding a worthy cause is a precious commodity. So I would say that in a sense, this is part of the dynamic here of we want to feel good for about what we stand for. We don't want to believe that our life is just about, you know, consumerism and trivialities. And maybe that's why such a video becomes viral, becomes so popular. There is a demand in our culture for meaning because, frankly speaking, we live in a culture where because we have too much, because we're too comfortable, we have strayed further and further away from the kind of meaning that one more easily finds in the daily struggle of some of these other societies. The point here is neither to say that, well, either we have pure, pristine, selfless, altruistic engagement or no involvement at all, because that's not the way the world works. We need to be savvy. We need to know how to engage in lobbying. We need to know how to manipulate the political process, and far too much feel-good activism is like Don Quixote running after the windmills and not thinking strategically about how you engage people in power. But on the other hand, we need to also have a high standard and understand that genuine empathy and engagement is actually far more satisfying, never mind how it helps those at the receiving end. But if we reduce humanitarianism also to a culture of instant gratification, where for, you know, 10 seconds, we want to see that YouTube clip and press on the PayPal button and make the donation and go on, that we've actually missed the point. We haven't really brought about any meaningful change. So I'm just fascinated by how all this has come back 10 years later when it was 10 years that no one really gave a damn. It was 10 years ago that all the donor states were saying to the Ugandan government, well, negotiate with Mr. Kony, give him the vice presidency, give him a ministry in the government. Why? Because no one was willing to accept that this man was a ruthless mass murderer who has to be treated as a criminal rather than a negotiating partner. So perhaps better late than never. At least the world now knows that there is this country called Uganda, that there is Joseph Kony, that these children who have survived the unthinkable. And my hope, at least, is that this pressure will persuade invisible children to reallocate those funds to where it is needed among those organizations in northern Uganda that have been doing great work. And I just want to add one last thing. One of the great Ugandan journalist, Rosabel Kagumira, I don't know if you've talked about her during this discussion or not, but she is a wonderful journalist who was an Eckenberg Fellow in our first McGill Human Rights. She is a fellow.
She was a young leader.
She is a fellow. We have the technicalities right. But I urge you to look at her blog, Rosabel Kagumire, K-A-G-U-M-I-R-E, and that's the kind of McGill Uganda connection that I think we can be proud of.
I'd just like to say one thing, is transnational actors, civil society, corporations, have become new pillars of governance structure worldwide. They are there to stay. And transnational involves all kinds of actors. So civil society is one, but not the only one. So we cannot make them go away. And I think someone mentioned the higher standard of accountability, transparency. There are many things, many elements which need to come in for these actors to become effective. But they hold more power in contexts where the local government is not doing what they should be doing. And I think we should hold them accountable in a globalized society also. So no one in this whole debate has ever said why Kony has been scot-free for years, when he's really traumatizing so many people in 1, 2, 3, 4 countries now. What these governments are doing, when Payam says that their soldiers know the bush and they can catch this guy. So if they had caught this guy whenever they had to, why they don't catch him? So so it is more complex than that. And I think invisible children and likes of them, and they are at least an advocacy group, they're corporations, and I think someone mentioned the mining lobby. They're there. And I think if you're following Africa, then there's this whole nationalism is taking place through Africa. And there's all kinds of partnerships being struck with large natural resource companies in Africa. So, but I think unless local governments, and I don't want to use the cliched good governance, but unless there is rule of law in a country, respect for law, that there are various democratic processes in place. Not trying to use the democracy as it is being used in U.S. election or as we understand, whatever it means for that context. And as the government cares, and so I do think that international actors will hold and wield a lot of power, continue to do so, in contexts where their own government is either weak or incompetent or corrupt or all of that. So I didn't want to end with that note, but I wanted to remind ourselves that what led us to come together was a video by a very nondescript group. Nobody had heard of them until now, but I think what we should leave with is bigger questions and challenges ahead. But I hope that all of us will continue to engage with this and whatever you want to engage with. So thanks so much for coming. And you can watch your comments and things when this is posted up.
And it goes viral. It's going to go viral.
And this will go viral. Of course, it'll be edited by Sienna. And, it'll be slick. So thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for coming. This is good.